of threatening behaviour or obstruction of the highway or obstruction of a police officer. It's very easy for them to get convictions on that basis.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's fairly clear that what they do is get them in a court, do their damnedest to convict them, and then bang on them very high fines and costs. The effect that's having, of course, is it's draining union resources, financial resources, because it costs an absolute bloody fortune.
Is that part of their policy?
No.
To drain
Well, it has that effect, and I've no doubt that they had that in mind when they started the mass arrests, because ultimately the union would have were forced into a position whereby we'd have to defend the lads. Mm. We're sending them picketing. We're going to have to. We have to ensure that they got the very best defences as well in court.
Mm.
Currently, this area, just Yorkshire area alone, has 28 firms of solicitors working for it on these cases. And in those firms, in the majority of them, there's more than one solicitor who has worked, who are working virtually full time on these cases. As the dispute has developed, the nature of the charges has changed a lot. Far more serious charges are being brought now than were in the first couple of months. In the first couple of months, the vast majority of charges were so ridiculously minor and so trumped up, so obviously trumped up, that it was clear to see how they were trying to organise their policy. What we do is, when we get informed that somebody's been arrested, either from a branch or from one of their friends or somebody on a picket line, that information comes to the strike centre, who tells me, and I ring up a solicitor in that area in the hope that he can get out and see it straight away and get before a court to represent him. Once we've got them out, we then interview. I've got a team of about 20 lads based at various places in Yorkshire. Get details of their witnesses so that we can, or any potential witnesses, so that we can interview them as well whilst the information is fresh in their lives. Because that's considerably different. That you don't interview them until several weeks after the thing's gone off. Most of them have forgotten what happened. Because there have been so many hundreds of pickets in the meantime. And the majority of lads, we're talking about a picket, like a composite picture of a picket in their mind. And when they're talking about a particular incident, they often are thinking about this, in fact, non-existent picket, which is a composite of hundreds that they've been to, rather than the one that we're interested in, where the guy they're a witness for got arrested. So that's why we have to get to them early. And that seems to be paying off. Since we started doing that, our conviction rate has gone down. And it does seem to be working. Just the fact, if you leave it till several weeks after, you get a situation whereby the bloke who was arrested can't remember who else was with him. And it's very difficult to trace them. But this way we can do that. And that's basically my function, to organise that and make sure it runs smoothly. And the police recently, particularly recent development, is to try and prevent that running smoothly. What they're doing is arresting people, taking them to one police station, and then moving them to another, and then to another, and then to another, to prevent us getting to them, to prevent the solicitors getting to them. We've actually had situations recently where solicitors have been ringing the police station to make inquiries about people, and the police have literally told them to fuck off. And these days work, you know. They clearly don't give a damn for the law anymore, the police, and they're deliberately engaging in this tactic so that they can keep people longer than they normally would be allowed to, and use it to get confessions out of them, because to be in a police station in this country is very intimidating.
Yeah.
Get one guy in an office with eight coppers all throwing questions at him. He'll end up saying anything they like in the hope that he might get out. They don't even need to beat them up. They're also trying a very divisive tactic these days, which is, over many years, has been a sort of standard police tactic in any event, but not generally used during this dispute, of using one person who's been arrested against another by going to the other and saying, this guy's made a statement saying that you've done this, that and t'other.
Mm-hmm.
And then show it, sort of quickly showing them a piece of paper and saying, yeah, there's a statement, you know, and don't let them see it in detail, of course. And then the guy who's been told that obviously is a bit pissed off that his mates dropped him in it. And then he might start making a statement against the other bloke.
Yeah.
You know? And that sort of thing's been happening quite a lot. We've had a guy in this morning who has been put in that position. He is the man who is supposed to have said, Joe Bloggs did this and Ron Smith did that, where in fact he never did. But because these lads have been told this, this guy is now very frightened and very worried. Obviously, he didn't say it. But the people who have been charged and been kept in custody as a result of what he's supposed to have said,
yeah,
are not very happy about it, and neither are their friends. And in fact, we're now trying to get a copy of his statement from the police so that we can prove to people that he never named them,
yeah,
that he never gave any information about them. And we've also got a thing occurring recently where people have just disappeared. Nobody knows what's happened to them. We're pretty sure there's about a dozen or more people in police stations in West Yorkshire. Nobody knows. We don't know their names, and until you can get a hang of a name on them, you can't get any access to them.
Yeah.
And again, they're involved in this thing of moving people from one police station to another, to another. And that's perhaps the most disturbing element of what's going on.
And that is a policy, not incidental case.
No, it's clearly a policy. Yeah. They're doing it quite deliberately. And taking that together with the fact that they tie telephones, it's obviously become clear to them that it does cause considerable difficulties for us in providing effective representation for those lads.
Yeah.
They also are choosing the courts before which they bring them. When we first started getting large numbers arrested in West Yorkshire, they started bringing them before Wakefield Court. And contrary to what we thought would happen, Wakefield Court wasn't imposing bail conditions, neither would they remain people in custody, which was good for us,
yeah,
good for the lads. So as soon as it dawned on the police that this was going to be the same in virtually every case, they stopped using that court. They simply stopped taking people there. And what they're doing now is taking them to Pontefract Court, where they can fairly guarantee they'll get magistrates who will impose bail conditions and remand people in custody virtually every time the police ask for it. So virtually everybody who's arrested now in West Yorkshire goes before Pontefract Court.
Is it legal to take somebody to another court?
Well, yeah, they can get away with it.
But it's legal.
It's legal, yes. In the sense that they can say they're doing it for purposes of convenience. It would be illegal if we could prove that they were doing it with a deliberate malicious intent.
Mm-hmm.
Because that would then become an abuse of the court process, and that would make it unlawful for them to do what they're doing. But we'll never actually be able to prove it, because to do it you have to make an application to the High Court in this country to get an injunction to prevent them doing it. The problem with that is every time we've been to the High Court, we've got screwed. And indeed the High Court are thoroughly enjoying themselves issuing injunctions against this union. And they're certainly not going to take any notice of anything we do or say. And on the two occasions when we've run test appeals to the High Court, the first one we ran was concerning the bail conditions. We said that, that under the statute which governs the imposition of bail, magistrates were not allowed to have a wholesale policy of imposing standard bail conditions on people. Now, every solicitor I've ever spoken to agrees with that. Even right-wing solicitors agree that they don't think that should be allowable, and they don't think the Bail Act allows them to do that. However, we go to the High Court and prove quite conclusively that the magistrates do have a policy, and in fact prove that the magistrates have conspired together to create this policy. And the magistrates haven't denied it. And the High Court has upheld the fact that they're entitled to have such a policy, which is clearly contrary to the wording of the statute. And it's clearly contrary to the practice of the courts ever since that statute was introduced in 1974. So now, it would apply not necessarily just to this dispute, but also to CND marches, virtually every situation where you may get large numbers of people gathering together, that the police and the courts can treat people in that way, arrest them, impose bail conditions on them to prevent them having any more demonstrations or marches until their case is dealt with. Now at the time we went to court on that, we had an acquittal rate of something like 70%. 70% of those who'd been before the court from Yorkshire area had not been convicted. But they'd spent an average of something like 132 days with bail conditions on them, which had stopped them, effectively stopped them picketing, or put them in a position whereby if they were picketing and got arrested again, the chances are they would be remanded in custody when they came up before the court. So we lost that, and it was clear during the course of that case in court, because I was there, that the judges had no intention of giving a decision in our favour, when it was also clear that we were right. And from the very outset, the judges just started arguing with us and agreeing with everything the Blue prosecution said. And what was even more alarming about it was that the magistrates were so convinced we would win, they didn't even appear themselves. They weren't represented in court. And the only reason there was anybody else on the other side was that the Attorney General, political appointment, intervened, and he employed a barrister and paid for a barrister to represent the government, the establishment point of view. And also the judge ordered that the police be joined into the action. Obviously we didn't want that, they were irrelevant to it, it was strictly a matter of interpreting a statute, but they joined the police into the action so that the police could submit affidavits, which are sworn statements, which effectively said that all miners on all picket lines everywhere were behaving like a bunch of maniacs. Clearly untrue, and clearly a lot of nonsense. But out of those affidavits, it became clear that, and in fact it was stated in a sworn statement, they said that on March the 14th, the present dispute between the NUA and the NCB started to affect Nottingham. Therefore, contingency plans were brought into operation. Now, at the time that occurred, whilst we were accusing them of having these contingency plans, because clearly they did have, they were denying that they ever had them. And then all of a sudden we get, several months later, sworn statements proving and them admitting that in fact they did have them. And it's clear that their roadblock policy was part of those contingency plans, because it was set up so easily and so quickly, and it was so efficient that it went hand in glove with all this burn conditions thing. And in fact, it's even more sinister than that, because they set up roadblocks in such a way that if we were sending, say, 1,000 guys down to go to 30-odd pits, to split up and go to all those different pits, the police weren't allowing that. They'd set up their roadblocks in such a way that the lads had no alternative but to go to one pit. So you've got a mass picket, which we didn't necessarily want to have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because it stopped effective picketing at the other pits. And early on in the dispute, when we had smallish pickets at numerous different pits in Nottingham, it was being very effective. For several days, there were quite a number of collieries in Nottingham. There were very few people working. They were just turning away picket lines. There wasn't any hassle, there wasn't any violence. Yeah. And the police, as soon as they realised that was happening, stopped all effective picketing by roadblocks and by, when people did get through, beating them up and smashing their cars up.
Yeah.
All of that sort of thing occurred. The other case we took to the High Court, which was a week or so ago, was concerning the roadblocks. We said it was illegal and the police had no power to set up roadblocks. Now, prior to this dispute starting, they'd never done it before. They didn't believe they had the power before this dispute started.
Of course.
What's that?
Well, this kid from there. Was there one over there? Do you agree?
Can I hear one of it?
It's just taking on Wade's statement. I'll do it anyway. I'll do it later. I'll explain it later.
Okay, cheers. So anyway, de facto they'd set up these roadblocks and we were saying that it was illegal for them to do it. And the way we did that was four men who'd been arrested at a roadblock who were insisting on their right to travel the highway were brought before the court for an offence of, for breaching the peace. Excuse me. Hello? Yes, Dickie. I didn't know they'd been arrested. Oh, dear. Just a sec. Were they taken through the court or were they given police bail? Oh dear. What's their names?
We've had the call by President
Wolf. My name is Wayne. Six more. Thanks, Doctor. Yeah, where was I? Talking about a roadblocks case. So these guys appeared, these four men appeared, were arrested, charged with breach of the peace, and the law on breach of the peace was effectively that for an arrest for breach of the peace to be lawful and for them to convict you, they will have to prove that a breach of the peace was imminent in terms of time and place. So we argued that to arrest somebody for a breach of the peace, which may or may not occur some 6 or 7 miles away, wasn't lawful because the law said it must be imminent in terms of time and place. And the way that law has normally been used, and up to the start of this dispute, the way it had ordinarily ever been used, was, say, a situation outside a football ground or outside a pub, where one guy is threatening to belt another guy and the police would arrest them to prevent that occurring, then that arrest would be lawful.
And that
incident would be, and that arrest would be imminent in time and place, having regard to the threat that the person who was arrested was making or to the situation he was creating. What the police were saying was they had a power to arrest people anywhere if they thought the place they were going to might have a breach of the peace. In other words, their argument was, say, that you get in a bus here to go to a demonstration in London, it would be lawful for them to arrest you in the bus here.
Where do they arrest most of the people? At a pit or...?
Well, most people have been arrested at pits whilst picketing.
And what are the numbers of other arrests?
We don't have a specific breakdown of statistics as to where people particularly have been arrested. The vast majority have been arrested on a picket line,
mm-hmm.
and a small number have been arrested at other places. But there have been several hundred, in fact, early on in the dispute, arrested at roadblocks. Which is really why this case was so important, apart from the fact we didn't want them having roadblocks.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the magistrates convicted these four guys, so we appealed that to the High Court. And our argument was, the arrest didn't take place in a situation where it could be said that there was a breach of the peace. A breach of the peace was likely or imminent in terms of time and space. And that those guys might have gone onto the picket and picketed quite peacefully and come home at the end of it. The prosecution said, no, we can arrest them anywhere. And in fact, at the High Court, we lost the case.
So they can...
But we lost for those four, but the judges still upheld the law, as we had argued it always was. So we're going to have to fight all those cases, because the prosecution aren't going to drop them. But what the judge said, and what doesn't make sense, is that if somebody objects to the police stopping them at the roadblock, that objection in itself can effectively be a breach of the peace. And that's why he convicted them. He said the commotion that they caused when they were stopped was a breach of the peace there. Not the breach of the peace that may have occurred 7 or 8 miles down the road. So where we have situations where people have simply sat in their cars and said, look, I've got a right to go in. I've got a right to go to this property that I'm going to. And you have no right to stop me. And they simply arrested him. Those people shouldn't, in law, be convicted. They shouldn't, in theory.
Mm-hmm.
But what the police will say, because they lie all the time, is that the guy got out of his car and started gesticulating and calling me a fucking bastard and stuff like that. And they'll convict him for that.
Yeah.
But even in that case, I mean, we asked one of the judges to withdraw because we said we thought he was so clearly biased against the NUN that he shouldn't sit on the case, and he withdrew. And to my mind, that proves that he accepts he was so clearly biased. And really, because of those cases and the way they've gone through court and the way the judges have dealt with them, it's become clear that there's no point in us appealing, because whatever the law says, they ain't going to find in our favour. They will find some way of getting around it, because they're working hand in glove with the bloody government. And basically, it would appear these days, it's illegal to be a minor and breathe, you know? That's the situation. The other thing they've done, which is very disturbing, is they brought in what they call stipendiary magistrates from other parts of the country to courts where we have large number of cases pending. And the worst courts are Scunthorpe, Rotherham and Chesterfield. Miners' cases are invariably dealt with only by stipendiary magistrates, although when they were appointed, the Home Secretary stated that the intention was they would deal with all kinds of cases, and it was just simply to ease the burden which was being imposed on the courts as a result of the larger numbers of arrests. But all those courts have a policy of any miner who comes into that court, whether he's on whether it's for a first appearance for them to impose a bail condition or whether it's for his trial, gets dealt with by only by stipendiaries, and they won't let the ordinary magistrates near them. Mm-hmm. Because the ordinary magistrates have a tendency to acquit them.
Yeah.
So we've got a situation where we've got these flying stipendiaries. Stipendiaries are sit on their own. They don't have other magistrates in court. They're professional lawyers. And some of these, two of these guys I know personally. One's an ex-prosecutor, and the other one is a barrister who spent 90% of his time prosecuting. And he's got a reputation as being prosecution minded. He's a shit, really. I mean, I knew the guy and I hated him. And when occasionally I used to get him imposed on me to defend old clients of mine, because I used to work in a solicitor's firm before I worked for the NUN. I used to sack him, I wouldn't have him. I used to get up to all kinds of machinations to avoid having him.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you've got a legal aid client, you get, for barristers, the system is you're effectively stuck with who you get. So to avoid having this guy, I would get my clients to sack me. And if they sack me, he couldn't work for me because I was instructing the barrister.
Yeah.
And of course after the case would then go off to be adjourned, because it would be adjourned. Couldn't be dealt with because there would be no effective representation then.
Yeah.
Next time I came up back for a trial, I would be re-employed and we'd have a different barrister. And this guy convicted virtually everybody who's been in front of him. I think there's only one guy he hasn't convicted out of maybe 300.
Yeah.
And he and the others impose incredible sentences compared to what the ordinary magistrates are imposing. They're sort of two or three times as much in terms of fines. Virtually all the miners who have been sent to prison have been sent to prison by stipendiary magistrates. And that's another part of the government are trying to justify these mass arrests by ensuring that they get as many convictions as possible.
Mm.
And it was clear to them that up till about 8 weeks ago, when these stipendiary magistrates started in earnest, that magistrates were simply not convicting that many people.
Yeah.
And they had to do something about it, because when the figures came out, it was clearly going to be the case that all these arrests were never justified.
Yeah.
And to justify it, they've got to get them convicted, so they impose these stipendiary magistrates on the courts, and they deal with the cases. And we've had cases which, I've got letters from solicitors, it's so clear that the prosecution case is just a pack of lies, and virtually, in some cases, they've more or less admitted it. And they've convicted even then, you know? There's no evidence at all. You get one cop come in and say, yes, I arrested this guy. And I arrested him because he was jumping up and down and shouting, fuck off, scab. And then another cop comes in and says, I arrested this guy. And I arrested him because he was throwing stones.
Yeah.
And their evidence can be that contradictory, and they convict them anyway. Isn't it? It's absolute lunacy.
Yeah.
So that's the situation we're having to deal with. And it's clear that there just ain't going to be much in the way of justice for miners,
right?
Simply because they're miners, and because the government have set the courts up and interfered in the process of the courts to a greater extent than they ever have in the whole history of this country.
That makes it very frustrating for me,
yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, it's supposed to be a separation of powers in this country. It's supposed to be part of the unwritten constitution that the government does not interfere in the process of the courts. Yet they clearly have. Indeed, we know that, but I haven't been able to get a copy. The Lord Chancellor has written to all of the magistrates' courts where miners are appearing, telling them that they've been too generous with legal aid to stop it. As a result of which, we've now got people, some for serious offences, before courts who will not grant legal aid in any circumstances. Not for anything. Because they've taken this letter so much to heart. They've taken it literally. They've taken it as though it's an instruction. Yet this guy, the Lord Chancellor, has no power to give such an instruction. And it's an abuse of the courts. That's what we've got. You got any questions?
Yeah. Do you give the minors at Pickett's instructions or and tell them on a pamphlet or something, tell them what could happen when they get arrested?
Well, we did that at the outset. Put it, and we had a little sort of piece of paper saying what their rights were. But it became so clear that the police weren't going to let them have any of these rights that it was just a waste of time. Normally, you'd be entitled to make a phone call. Normally, you wouldn't get arrested in circumstances such as this. Normally, you'd be entitled to be fed and given a drink in a police station. And indeed, the law requires it. But they never were. I during the whole dispute, I've only ever had one phone call from a police station from a guy who's been in custody, only once. And that only happened because the copper who were there thought it were a big old... He thought it was funny. I could hear them laughing in the background.
I thought that in England it was allowed, that the person who was...